the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the MadTech Podcast. I'm Rachel Smith, CEO with ExchangeWire, and I'm delighted to welcome my guests for today's session. Dave Randall, Commercial Director with Future. Hello, Dave.
Hello. Very nice to be here.
Welcome to the new ExchangeWire office. We accidentally told Dave to go to the old ExchangeWire office.
Yeah, it's really helped with my diaphragm, you know, but taking those stairs up four flights, then coming back down again. Hopefully my speaking voice is delightful now as a result.
Do apologise. And our senior editor for ExchangeWire, Matt Broughton, welcome.
Hello to you, Rachel. I'm delighted to be sat here on this very bedazzling rug.
Oh, yes. We've got some interesting interior decoration in the new ExchangeWire office. So open invitation to all listeners to pop round. We'll give you the correct address. Right. So let's dive into news stories for the week. First news story I wanted to chat through with you two is that the CMA have launched another antitrust probe into Google's business. Specifically this time, they're going to be looking at Google's ad tech stack. Listeners might recall that earlier on in the year, they announced that they'd be launching an investigation into Jedi Blue, which is the allegation that Google gave Facebook preferential rates and priority choice of prime ad placements in return for them not building competitive ad technologies. Now, the CMA have decided to take aim at the overall construction of Google's ad tech stack. Specifically, they're going to be looking at the company's control over their DSP, the Ad Exchange, and publisher ad server. So what's interesting about this is that Google currently hold 50 to 60% of market share for their DSP, 80 to 90% for their ad exchange, and an unbelievably dominant, some would argue anti-competitive sum of 90 to 100% when we start looking at publisher ad server. So this is going to make for really interesting reading, right? Now, Ciaran has been saying for quite some time that he thinks that Google should sell AdX voluntarily anyway. If they don't, perhaps they'll be forced to. And he also has said quite some time ago that he always thought that the acquisition of DoubleClick was the thing that really started Google down this anti-competitive route and perhaps should never have been approved in the first instance. But really interested in your perspective on this, Dave. What do you make of this? And I suppose what I'm really interested in as well is whatever the CMA does, is this actually going to result in some significant change?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the surprising thing is how it's taken so long for them to look at this, right? I mean, the CMA is there for a reason, and Future Publishing has had brushes with the CMA themselves, and we can come on to what they were. But I mean, fundamentally, they are there to make sure that there's effective competition in the market. And those stats that you just read out suggest that maybe there is a dominant force with Google. So it's, you know, in my opinion is that they're, you know, they've got their own publisher ad server. They've got a DSP. They've got exchange services. If you add all of those things together, then if it's controlled by one person, then obviously there's concern if there's a lack of transparency around what they could be doing with that and what kind of rules and regulations they could be marking themselves in order to promote their own products as opposed to other vendors within the ecosystem. So yeah, it's I think it's a good thing that it's being looked at. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're misbehaving, but it should be checked.
Yeah, 100%. And it's interesting, you raise an interesting point there. What they're specifically going to be looking at is whether Google having these products means that they have been steering customers towards those as an option over alternative products and competitors' products. So, and the other thing as well is that, you know, sometimes it's worth concentrating on these things because we hear of a lot of anti-competition activity both here and over in the US. The entire point of this investigation is to work out whether Google's actually broken the law when it comes to competitive activity. So, yeah, it sounds like, as ever, the devil's going to be in the detail. Matt, what's your point of view on this?
I think, you know, it will really come down to how it's enforced, because we need meaningful enforcement here. Google's not just going to change its business model on a whim. It's only going to do that in response to either market pressure, for example, in terms of it responding to Apple's privacy changes, or government enforcement. It's not going to do that off its own back. What is good to see is that the market is becoming kind of more aware of this, you know, alleged anti-competitive behaviour, and responding to those legal concerns. We've just published some research which is showing that across Europe, publishers are moving away from big tech because of these legal concerns. But yeah, it'll be really important to see how the CMA actually rules upon this. There is some legislation going through in the US which is very clear in terms of its scope. It says basically, if you're getting more than $20 billion worth of ad revenue, you need to divest part of your stack. Mm. If you're, you know, generating more than $5 billion, then you really need to open your doors in terms of what data you're sharing and what you're seeing, so you're not essentially marking your own homework. Here, there's a bit of, you know, toing and froing because the legislation, it's in development at this stage, and it'll still be at draft stage next year, according to the Queen's speech. So it's going to be interesting to see how it could be enforced.
And that is something that makes me want to hear a bit more from you, Dave. From a publisher's point of view, what is your perspective on, I mean, this is a big question and perhaps we'll come on to it in the second part of the podcast anyway, but what's your point of view on diversifying your technology options? Does it feel as though, you know, actually this is a good time for publishers to make sure they're not reliant on just one or two tech solutions? What's the approach at Future?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, well, the approach at Future is that Google's a big partner of ours. You know, we rely on their search results, and the majority of the audiences that come through to Future are based upon searches. And that's great for us because it means that they come to our sites and they're really far down the purchase funnel because they've already made a decision to find something, and then they come to us as the experts in whatever area it may be, whether it's technology to buy a new TV or whether it's to buy a new guitar from Guitar World. But we, you know, we are there and we run our business digitally on making sure that our SEO results are great. Now, the flip side of that is that we also work with social to expand social reach, and we have e-commerce partners as well. So we interact with all of the ecosystem because our business is naturally diverse anyway.
Yeah.
So I think if you're one publisher relying on one ad tech partner with one business model, that's where it can become quite tricky. Mm. So diversifying is always important, regardless of what business you're in my opinion.
Mm. And tell us a bit, slightly off topic, but I'm intrigued. Tell us a bit about Future's brush with the CMA.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, we're a really acquisitive business.
Yeah, right.
As you would have seen over the last 6 months to, well, really the last 3 years. And but the one that sticks in mind for me is when we acquired TI. So Future in the US and the UK is the biggest technology consumer portfolio, and it has the biggest technology consumer portfolio. So when we bought TI, the CMA came in to see whether that was going to be compliant and whether there were some anti-competition regulations that were there. And they had trusted reviews. Now, in order for us to purchase TI in its entirety, we couldn't buy trusted reviews because it would mean that we would have an absolute majority within those markets. So that had to be spun off to a different publisher. But, you know, it would have been great for us to have it because it would have meant that we would be dominating. But obviously, we have to respect that, and those regulations are there in place for a reason. And I think it becomes more of an ethical question as well around why it's important to have competition. And I think competition makes anybody better at what they do, whether it be sports or whether it be business. You know, if you're just the one person there, then you could just be doing the same old thing, and then you're not really progressing or innovating value for your clients or customers. So I think it's great that the CMA is here, and it's good that they're investigating these things because it makes us all better at what we do, and it makes us more ethical as companies.
I mean, you just raised so many interesting things there, Dave, and I'm now going to direct this at Matt to avoid any awkward moments here. But like, Dave's just given a rundown on how to ethically run your company. We've had so many conversations here about why Google runs their business the way that they do. You know, why does it have to take the CMA intervening for them to, I mean, you know, you've shared your opinion, which is that you think that they won't do anything voluntarily, but I don't know. It's a, you know, moral question. Why not? It is obvious that they are dominating. What could they have done to prevent this?
Yeah, I think Dave makes a good point in terms of the CMA and other kind of regulatory bodies have been very good at regulating acquisitions as and when they're coming in. They're not necessarily, maybe because the legal kind of footing for it isn't there in terms of retroactively acting on acquisitions. Obviously, we always come back to the DoubleClick acquisition as kind of where this all stems from. But kind of retroactively acting on that, it hasn't been possible at this stage. Whether that becomes, possible in the future, I'm not necessarily sure. Whether this investigation will kind of bring that into focus as well. But in an ideal world, Google would kind of bring these changes in to foster a more open ecosystem. But at the end of the day, they've got to protect their shareholders, and they're making an absolute shed ton of money. So
it's super complex, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it is. It's so complex. I know it's not straightforward,
and it's opaque, and it's deliberately so. I mean, DoubleClick. You mentioned DoubleClick and Kieran's views on that, but DoubleClick has been rebranded now, so that makes it even more tricky to decide what to do with it.
Deliberately so, I would argue. But yes.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, what we're talking about here is a business that's been around for 20 years and is absolutely huge, and it's evolved into what it is. And it has a dominant share for a reason. And where do you search when you go on the internet? Where do you need to find the exchange? Our offices, you might go to Google Maps, right?
And it might not give you the right address. Potentially anyway.
Not at the moment, but we're fixing that, surely.
Yes.
But the Gmail's another one. It brings value to customers, but obviously it's grown to what it is, but it now needs to be regulated somewhat in order to make it more compliant, I think. So, it's a work in progress, and the CMA's just started doing this, so I think that's the good thing from this story.
Yes, definitely. And one final point on this, I wonder if the two of you agree. I mean, could it be also that actually the technology solutions that form part of an ad tech stack have not been very well understood from a government and regulatory point of view until now. I don't mean right this moment. I mean, let's say the last 4 or 5 years. You've started to see, legislative bodies really trying to get to grips with the complexity of advertising technology. Is it fair to say that actually, way back in 2007 when the DoubleClick acquisition was made, people just didn't really understand necessarily the potential power of these technologies platforms and what those businesses might grow into?
I think that's a very fair point, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, it's evolved into something completely different now. I mean, DoubleClick was the ad server that was used at the time, and now arguably it's got various different webs across the ecosystems that has turned it into a different beast. So yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really fair point.
Yeah. Okay. So moving on to another conversation about regulation and legislation. GDPR turned 4 last week. Can you believe it?
Happy returns.
I wonder if it had a birthday party. But what's interesting is that we've seen this week and last week in the news a lot of commentators coming out pointing out that actually GDPR, whilst for many reasons it's been useful for heralding in the beginning of more coherent protections for data privacy and for consumer control, that actually it hasn't necessarily been very effective in bringing, in resolving complaints that have been brought forward by various DPOs throughout Europe. That's data protection officers, yes, data protection, yep, that's right. And that more frustratingly, where there have been rulings made, actually implementing some consequences as a result of that and taking forward some fines and actually acting on those legislative decisions has been slow. Overall, there's also a lot of commentary to suggest that this in totality has meant there hasn't really been a big impact on the way big technology companies operate some of their data gathering and data processing activities. So are we in a position where we're looking at the effectiveness of GDPR and asking ourselves what has it actually achieved? The EU, in response to, or EU officials rather, in response to some of this criticism, do point out that obviously legislation takes quite a long time to bed in and to become fully effective. And we always thought that in the early days, 4 years ago, when we were debating what GDPR would turn the industry into. I think there was lots of conversation at the time that it will be a test and trial situation. Legislation's there as a sort of basic fundamental sort of basis for deciding what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate needs to be tested in court of law, needs to be then tested in a real life situation. So my question to the both of you is, what has GDPR achieved, and do we need to see perhaps further legislative changes to give it a little bit more power and structure to actually bring forward some rulings that might have an impact on how the industry operates? Matt?
So firstly, I'd say GDPR has been, truly revolutionary in the sense that it's, forced companies of all sizes to, rightfully consider how their consumer data is being managed. And we've got upcoming legislation from the EU in terms of the Digital Markets Act and the Digital Service Act, which is kind of going to shore up some of the more ambiguous elements in terms of the legislation and addressing, the scale of companies. One main criticism of GDPR so far is that it's unfairly hindered smaller companies relatively to larger companies, and I think those two pieces of legislation are going to address that somewhat. But I think enforcement so far, whether you look at it from the argument of, it's a new piece of legislation, it's going to take time, or whether it has been mismanaged, it just has been horribly inconsistent so far, and there hasn't been too much clarity in terms of where fines have been implemented, how they've actually gone about that. As an example of that, there's been a recent fine implemented by the ICO against a company called Clearview AI, which essentially harvested 20 billion facial images worldwide. The ICO has fined it £7.5 million. Now, given that that data that they used ticked all the boxes in terms of could be special category data, it's been sold on, it could be used for behavioural tracking, It's unclear as to why they didn't go further in the fine, especially given that Clearview didn't actually cooperate. It didn't tell the ICO how much revenue it was getting, and therefore couldn't be, fined potentially more if, the fine could have come to 4% of its annual worldwide turnover.
Well, I mean, it's a good question, right? Because if we think back to a few years ago when, what was it? Was it BA who voluntarily put their hands up and said, we've had a data breach, and they were fined a phenomenal amount of money, significantly more than $7.5 million.
They were going to be fined $183 million, but that was toned down to $20 million.
Because of cooperation.
Yes.
Yeah.
But again, it's just how that kind of sliding scale is applied.
Yeah.
There's still questions there, and I think, those questions, I do have sympathy for the DPAs. I think it's kind of been sprung on them, and the one-stop shop is, I think it needs to be ironed out, and I think there is progress being made. But yeah, so far I think that enforcement piece is what needs to be really, really tightened up.
Yeah. Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I guess playing devil's advocate somewhat, if GDPR wasn't there, then you'd have no money. And companies could kind of do what they want. So, I read an article recently that said GDPR is failing, and I just don't think that's true. Mm. It's evolved. It's been 4 years. We mentioned it's a four-year birthday, and 4 years ago, it was all about what GDPR is going to be. Everybody was talking about, what's it going to be? How do we become compliant? How do we collect and store our data safely and appropriately? And that was groundbreaking at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, things have moved on now, but there have been fines, and we've just discussed a couple of them, and I think that that's what it's there for. There was another one, H&M was fined in Germany, La Liga, the Spanish Football League, was fined. Yep. Even the Netherlands tax body has been fined, all because of uncompliant GDPR. So there's that. But then there's also more intangible benefits as well from GDPR, which is that we are more aware of our data and more, again, aligned to what we should and shouldn't do with people's data. So, and companies are doing that across the board. And not only companies, but individuals and consumers are much more aware of what their data is and being careful around who's taking it. So there are benefits to it. But I think the big but is, how do you actually start to enforce that on companies that have swathes of cash and loads of lawyers that can very easily counteract that, or at least delay a process? And I think that's really where we should be looking at, how can we evolve the product, and or not the product, how can we evolve the process further?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. It's sort of like the difference between how GDPR has changed behaviours, whether that's, you know, personally, individually, or at a company level. And you make a good point, Dave, and also Matt, you made the same point too, that this applies unilaterally, right? So we're not just talking about application of this law to commercial companies, but it also equally applies to charitable organisations, to government organisations. And I think that's a really important potential level playing field piece, right? Which is we're not just as a society focusing on how data is, you know, held and kept and used in a public sector context, but it's also just as important in a consumer commercial context. It's had the ancillary benefit of making people much more aware of data practices in general. But then you've got this other side of the fence, which is actually the application of the law, the notion of consequences if you don't behave appropriately, and whether that's actually even going to weed out the really serious bad actors who will always be looking for a way to circumvent legislation like this and use data for nefarious purposes.
Yeah, and I think that is almost an existential question around crime and punishment.
You mean we can't solve that on the MadTech podcast this morning, Dave? Jeez.
Well, look, it's an EU policy, and therefore the member states of the EU have to enforce that law. They've got an obligation to provide sufficient resources to, you know, carry out their duties. And fundamentally, as we know, when it comes to member states, there's bureaucracy and red tape that's involved, and that takes a long time. And that is up against huge companies with loads of reserves and lots of lawyers that are buttoned up. And that's what we're looking at here. So you've got this ongoing battle that's going to be a long, long process before it actually gets resolved, which is why I think we were talking at the start of it, is what can be done with GDPR to evolve it into something that can be a little bit more cut through.
Yeah. And maybe to a certain extent, you know, these two stories are certainly weaving in and out of one another. This perhaps goes hand in hand as well from a regulatory point of view with trying to contain and control the way big corporations and organisations work and operate, and what kind of, you know, business practices that they get involved in, whether they be anti-competitive or otherwise. To what extent do you think that we might see an acceleration of sophistication around data practices and data protocols as a result? And one thing I'm particularly interested in, and I have to declare my ignorance here, is, and does anyone else on the podcast know, where are we at in the UK with mirroring GDPR legislation? My understanding is that what we've currently got in place, now we're not part of the EU, is pretty much the same. But I know there's been talk of, MPs wanting to undo some elements of that. I'm looking here at you, Matt. I'm imagining that you know, because you know everything, but, you know, it's also fine if you don't know.
Because I'm a nerd that looks at legislation and draft online bills. In terms of GDPR, it's broadly mirroring what's happening in terms of the EU. In terms of divergence from that, there hasn't been too much yet. I know we're going to diverge a little bit more in terms of the aforementioned kind of DMA and DSA, mm-hmm. but in terms of GDPR, it's largely going to go hand in hand at this point, whether or not, you know, they decide, let's rip this up and start something new, because that's what the government seems to want to be doing at the moment. Mm. But yeah, at the moment, we're largely mirroring it.
And where do you think we're going to go? Do you think we'll start seeing a bit of an acceleration of, I don't know, either fines or activity or tightening up of the legislation over the coming year or so?
I think it's probably going to remain at the same pace. I think it's interesting because it's being brought to the surface, but, you know, really this has been a 10-year process. If you think about 10 years ago when there was nothing in place versus now where every company is talking about cybersecurity and data protection and privacy. I mean, it's a completely different world, but that's taken 10 years. And just because we're now talking about, oh, right, so now that we know what GDPR is and we've got it in place, what are we going to do with it? Mm. Like, that might take another 10 years. Yeah. I don't think it's going to be an acceleration.
Good point. Matt, final word on that one?
No, I completely agree. I think, you know, the law is so reliant on precedent that nobody wants to dive in and make that first move unless it's really been considered. And if, you know, the DPAs aren't necessarily fully on top of all the potential implications of their rulings, then they're not going to go charging in, which is understandable. But yeah, I think definitely some streamlining of GDPR in terms of that enforcement could could help accelerate things. But yeah, otherwise I think it's going to be slow and steady progress.
Okay, moving on to third news story that I wanted to chat through. Stock prices of social media companies have taken a tumble recently. Anything between 7 and 24% down of some of the big social media companies we'd be familiar with across Twitter, Facebook and others. Snap in particular announcing a warning to their investors that the macroeconomic environment has deteriorated further and faster. Oh, so that'll be our Crosstown Donuts delivery. Lucky you, Dave, you're in the office just at the right time. I was just reading out a quote there from Evan Spiegel. The macroeconomic environment has deteriorated further and faster than anticipated. And, end quote, paraphrasing here now, shareholders should expect to see some revised earnings for the quarter. So that made their stock tank, an impact on other social media platforms, tech stocks. We're starting to see quite a bit of downward movement in tech stocks across the board anyway, in financial markets. We're seeing lots of commentary on the state of financial markets in a general capacity, and concerns of a recession are growing amongst rising interest rates and global energy crisis. How significantly are all of these factors impacting social media platforms? We know that, for example, online spending has taken a bit of a dive this year. Are we in a situation where we're looking at social media platforms in particular that perhaps had boom times during the height of the pandemic and are just kind of coming out of those boom times? Or are we actually looking at some of these social media platforms really about to struggle big time with how they're going to be faring these financial headwinds, Dave? What do you reckon? Are you distracted by the Crosstown Donuts?
I am a touch, yeah, but, well, they look great. Sorry. So what are we talking about, Snap?
Donuts out.
Look, I think it's almost a bit of a perfect storm, and it's not just social media companies. It's any online business that has been doing well over the pandemic. So, you know, audiences were hugely up because people weren't going out. Now people are going out, audiences are somewhat down, and you know what you do with as a result of that is about how well you manage your business and what your fundamentals are like. Combining that with what's happened in Ukraine, plus a cost of living crisis because of the energy crisis, it means that times are kind of tough. Where you know there was a bit of a boom, now the entire industry, and it's not just our industry, it's others as well, unless maybe you're in oil and gas. But everybody's facing this, and the fundamentals of the business are what we should be looking at. And I think that Snap is a strong business, and it remains one of the big social media players, and it has a specific generational quality to it, which is always going to be needed from advertisers. So I think in the long run, they should be fine. But at the same time, they have suffered more than Meta and obviously Alphabet. And plus you have TikTok, which we haven't even spoken about here because who knows how much money they're making, but they've definitely come in and they are a major, major player in social media at the moment. But it shows that there's a diversification and there's competition within social media. And unfortunately for Snap at this particular time, it looks like they're suffering somewhat, but it doesn't necessarily mean that's the end of them. I think it just means that they have to really review what they're doing from a cost basis perspective, and maybe like some of the experimental new products or innovations that they might be looking at, where they might need some cash for it, might have to go on the back burner for a little while. But you know, it is what it is, and we're in this situation collectively at the moment. And I think in the long run they'll be fine.
Yeah, Matt.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think much to the devastation of Mark Zuckerberg and his dystopian headset-clad nightmare, people are going out now. Obviously, we saw tech companies and you know these you know, companies that I mentioned in terms of Snap, Meta, et al. Obviously, do really well in the pandemic. But there's now a correction because we are no longer in those market conditions. I'm not an economist at all, but I'm very surprised that there's been a 40% drop in Snap's value when all they've done is essentially go, you know what, our results may not be as good as we thought they'd be before the world went to shit. So,
I think you both raised really good points, and ultimately this comes down to how well these businesses are being managed internally, right? As Dave says, what do you do when times get tight? Well, you look at where you're spending your money, and you maybe things that you had in the roadmap, maybe you can't afford right now, and so you just put them on the back burner, you focus on other activities, you get back to basics, whatever that might be for the type of business that you're running. But I guess the question here is, you know, when we're looking at stock prices, and I am also very, very far away from being a financial analyst, is it a case case that these stocks were overvalued in the first instance? Are we seeing a 40% drop because actually they were overvalued to begin with? Are we seeing a 40% drop because this is just people, investors, shaky investors who were perhaps never that confident in the first instance, just immediately reacting?
Is it that, or is it just that there are investors that saw the value of that stock and decided to sell at the right time?
Mm. Yes. I suspect since Dave is chief commercial officer, he's the economist out of the three of us.
I honestly, I'm not chief commercial officer. I'm just a lowly commercial director. but yeah, I mean, there's various reasons of why the stock price has gone down. But I think, as I said, it's an amalgamation of everything that we've just spoken about.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's having the foresight to do the right thing if you're an investor and you have that cash. And, you know, those that put money into oil and gas a year ago, or even those that did a fixed price on their energy bills over a year ago, I'm very jealous of.
Yes.
But, you know, that's sometimes it's backing the right horse, sometimes it's luck, and sometimes you know what you're doing. But I honestly think with this one, it's the macroeconomic environment, just like the CEO of Snap said it was. I think that all of those factors are contributing to what's happened. And honestly, I think that once the storm passes, then who knows what could happen to the stock. I think it's probably going to go back up again.
And, you know, we haven't even had an opportunity to talk much about the sort of potential trajectory of various social media platforms just in theory, which is that, you know, given the demographic of users on Snap and TikTok, perhaps even younger on TikTok, ultimately it's not as though that's a demographic that will have changed their behaviour enormously. And imagine if they're dictating what the next rising social media platform might be. I think we've talked about it before here in the office. 10 to 1, there's probably a social media platform over in China somewhere that we haven't even heard of that's going to be the next big thing that will land on our shores before we know it. I mean, you know, we are still going to see activity, consumption, content consumption continue to grow in some respects in digital channels, right? This is not, you know, that's where our world is headed, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Dave was spot on in terms of mentioning TikTok earlier, because the amount of content being consumed there is absolutely ridiculous. Obviously, you've got, you know, the likes of Meta, Pinterest, Twitter, Snap, even Netflix to some extent, looking at how to capture that attention in the way that TikTok is able to, particularly amongst the younger generation. And that company has yet to kind of fully spread its wings in terms of what it can offer in terms of, say, like the commerce side, for example. So, you know, these are, you know, in terms of Meta, in terms of Pinterest, in terms of Twitter, they are kind of more, I don't want to say legacy attention economy businesses, but they are, you know, of the previous generation.
Older generation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So they are going to be relatively closely tied. And I think where TikTok is doing so well, it proves that there is still, you know, still benefits from that attention economy. It's just how to capture that.
Yep. Sort of same overall amount of attention. It's just who's getting it and for doing what.
Yeah, it's a sensitive market. And when sensitive things happen in the market, people go to what they know and they go for stability. And you're absolutely right. You know, Meta, Twitter, these have been around a touch longer and we're more used to looking at how we can interact with those companies. And I think that might have something to do with it as well.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on to second part of the podcast. Dave, tell us a bit about what's going on at Future at the moment.
Oh, there's lots. Mm. The one thing that we're really excited about at the moment is actually quite linked in quite nicely with, you know, GDPR and first party data, which is the product that we've built out called Aperture, which is our first party data offering. I'm fully behind it, and it's been great for us to launch within the market because it literally gives us a protection and stability from an advertising point of view, but also as helps the rest of the diverse business set, and it's come from the commercial team, which is great. Effectively, what Aperture is the first party data products where we collect data from users that land on our sites, and therefore it's, you know, GDPR compliant. It's our data, so we can use it in a compliant way, which is great. And it future-proofs us against the demise of the cookie. Mm. So, you know, when you hear all of these different conversations, and I've listened to many of your podcasts, and what's going to happen, I actually feel very confident and comfortable sitting at Future because of this product that we've been building out with our tech team and how that's expanding throughout the organization. And it links in really nicely too with the acquisitive nature of the business that we have at Future. And, you know, I mentioned that we bought TI before, but recently we've got What Culture. And the big one from, nearly 2 years ago now, I think, was Go Compare, which was obviously an acquisition that nobody really saw. And everybody kind of thought, well, why have they done that? And now if you think about what we've done with Go Compare, it takes us into the service industry. So there's a step there, which diversifies our business. But also, what happens when you go to Go Compare? You type in your information and you ask for a service, and that data is collected compliantly. And then what we can do is take that data and put it into a central data lake. So when we look at targeting from an advertising point of view, it's not just, okay, so what are our users doing on TechRadar or Marie Claire? It's actually, okay, so what are our users doing outside of that in a different ecosystem? And we can get that qualitative data in as well, and crunch it all within a specific data lake, so we can take information from behaviors across our websites, from Go Compare, from B2B services, from our e-commerce platform to show intent of advertising, and really do some interesting stuff within the portfolio of the internet. And I think that that's a really fascinating thing for us. And that stemmed from really us reacting and saying, right, well, what are we going to do about the demise of the cookie? And now we have a product that not only helps us from an advertising perspective, but can be utilized across that diverse business set for the entire organization.
So fascinating. It's literally sounds in practice like many of the things we've been talking about in theory for the last few years. So it's really fascinating to hear you speak about that from experiencing it firsthand. What do you think? So the first question is, how are advertisers reacting to this? How are marketers and brands and people that are buying inventory within or across Future properties reacting to this?
I think we've had it's been a soft sell to start with, because obviously we've been building it and soft launching it somewhat. But where it's worked really well is because, I mean, fundamentally, it works. The results have been good.
I like that you're almost surprised.
I guess I'm being a little ironic. Bit humble or ironic about it. But look, it's been working, and it's a powerful piece of kit. So when we do run it, we have the KPIs and the responses and, you know, the reports after the campaigns that run to say, you know, this is great and it's been working. And then you get repeat business, which is obviously makes the actual chief commercial officer very happy. So that's great. But we have had some teething issues with explaining what it is to companies and advertisers, because they initially maybe thought that we were selling them a data product. And actually, that's not the case. So what we're doing is providing them a service that is another line on their media plan. It's not as if we're saying, hey, you should use our data product. It's, we've got a data product and this works and you can tap into it. So we've had some interactions with advertisers having to just go through that explanation of what it is. It's not like we're saying, you should use this piece of kit, phone network company. Yeah. It's more of a case of, hey, come to us, do your contextual buying as you normally do, and then we can give you an audience extension based upon whatever you want, like age or behaviors or how much money someone earns, whatever it might be.
That is also really interesting, right? Because it says a lot about the way in which brands and sort of advertisers have previously transacted when it comes to buying particular audiences and what they expect around data. The idea that, in years gone by, it would have been about potentially buying data and data segments. Now it's different. And who do they go to for that support? And who do they go to for that, advice and guidance? So that sort of leads into two things we've been talking about a lot, which is, what does the relationship between the advertiser and the publisher look like these days? It feels like it's getting a lot closer. It's becoming much more consultative. And so, yeah, what does that make your business as a traditionally a publishing business that is now expanding and becoming more diverse?
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's not just the advertisers, it's the agencies as well, right? So, so we are very much looking to work much more collaboratively with agencies and advertisers as a result of this. And I think once we've got the definition right and those other businesses understand what it is that we can offer, then it becomes really interesting and we can do some really fun stuff with the technology. It could be that clean rooms is an opportunity for us, and it's something that we can absolutely turn on right now. So we could be sharing data in a very compliant and safe way with advertisers, and then we can start to do bespoke advertising around that data platform in a way that we've never really been able to do before. And I think really it's only walled gardens that had the possibility to do that. And arguably maybe they haven't been doing it because they're protecting what they have. So we absolutely want to be more collaborative with advertisers and agencies in order to build these new diverse product sets out in a compliant way to show that, you know, we can be successful and utilize not just the information that we've collected compliantly, but that they've collected compliantly. And if you can combine those two together, then you've got some really interesting capabilities there for the future.
Yeah, really compelling. So we've also been talking quite a bit at ExchangeWire about how the industry is going to perhaps shake out into a proliferation of walled gardens, or shall we say discreet buying environments. Do you recognise the identity of future within that somewhere?
Yes. Mm, yeah. Yeah, very much so. I mean, look, I think we view ourselves as the internet because we have access to, from a UK perspective in particular, you know, we've got access to probably more than one in two people within the UK. So outside of those walled gardens, future we look at as, right, here's the internet. Now, obviously, it doesn't have newspaper access, and there are various other publisher competitors that are out there to use. But the fact is, the audiences that come to us cross-pollinate across the internet, and therefore we can provide advertisers with something that isn't within a traditional walled garden or data company or social media company, that is more aligned to brands and passion points, really. And that's what future's about, like connecting people with their passions. And therefore we can say, right, so we have this contextually powerful stuff written by human beings for those people that are interested in this stuff, whatever it might be. Oh, and not only that, but we have all the data on them as well. So would you like some?
There's so many more questions, but we're running out of time. Just one last question, because you mentioned that this product in particular originated in the commercial team.
Yeah.
What has, from a structural point of view, how has that conversation of how do we organise ourselves from a first party data point of view? How do we make sure that we're diversifying our revenue streams? Where within the business has that been coming from? Has it always been a commercial push, or is it from a number of different angles?
I should probably give you some more clarity on that, insofar as like Aperture, the product itself, like yes, how we manage the first party data from an advertising point of view, that came from the commercial team. And yep, then the building out of that and pulling the data in from those diverse business sets has allowed us to really expand it throughout the organization. But the yep, product Aperture, that came from the commercial team.
Yeah,
we have a fantastic executive leadership team, and they are hugely innovative. And we, you know, innovation can come from within, and it can come from M&A. The fact that we bought GoCompare, that's innovation within itself. So I would have to defer to somebody within the exec team as to those decisions. I'm just lucky enough to be there to, you know, be able to build a product out with our tech team, which is Aperture, that allows us to run those campaigns in the way that we are. But we do have a very, very innovative company, but it very much stems from the exec team and the really smart people that we have running our tech portfolio.
It's really fascinating, because we also talk quite a lot about this particular sort of age that we're living through of marketing and advertising being very, you know, sort of consumer focused and data privacy led, is giving a lot more power and control to publishing businesses so that they can really design what type of businesses they want to build and own. You could argue that, you know, rowing back certainly as much as 10 years, there was that period of time was characterized by the idea, whether it was reality or not, of publishers sort of losing control somewhat over their business. Does that feel familiar?
It does, yeah, especially considering I worked for a tech stack for 6 of those years. I mean, look, the publishers are now getting their sovereignty back as a result of what they can do with their data and what they can do with their content. And data and content is the key to us as an organization. And that very much allows us to say, right, well, we own this, and we are going to be using this in a good and powerful way for the benefit of our customers and our stakeholders. So, I totally agree with you on that one. It feels as if publishers, if they get their onions right and they get the ducks in a row, are in a really, really good position at the moment. And actually, I think that's a really good thing, because it's the advertisers and publishers that allow ad tech companies to thrive, and choosing the right ad tech companies and using them in the right way that's benevolent and compliant and doing the best for the customers at the end of the day is the most important thing.
Yeah. Well said. Time for donuts.
Thank God.
Thank you very much, Dave. Appreciate you coming all the way to the correct Exchange Wire offices for our podcast today. It was great to have you on.
No problem. I just wish there was a zip wire between buildings, but thank you very much.
And thank you very much, Matt. Enjoyed your insights. Thanks for being our guest on the podcast.
Thank you, Rachel. We'll blow out a candle for GDPR and give it a birthday wish.
Stick one in a donut.
I was about to say, exactly. Stick it in a cross-town donut. And thanks, everyone, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.